everybody. Happy Saturday morning to you. House State Affairs Committee will come to order. It's 5 minutes after 10. And on March 24th, Saturday, I might point out to our listening audience. And this morning, we're going to be hearing in this order, I believe, HB 92, which involves jurisdiction of the Ombudsman, HB 151, involving indemnity clauses in public contracts, and HB 171, measures to accommodate the 90-day session. So with that, let's begin with HB 91, and I would invite Representative Stoltz to join us. And I guess Representative Sandler is going to join us also.
Is it 91?
91 or 92?
I beg you, it's 92.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
91 might be a better bill.
We might want to hear that one.
But we'll work with 92.
There is no better bill, Mr. Chairman.
There is no better bill.
Is this another planet-saving bill, Mr. Representative?
make a note of that. He said there's no better bill. Okay. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chairman of the Committee, for your work ethic here on a Saturday morning. I know there's a lot of more fun things to do, and I appreciate the work you've done in this committee. House Bill 92 is I would call it a clarifying bill regarding the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman in relation to the Office of Victims' Rights. I bring my opinion that's merely a clarification, having been staff that worked on creation of the Office of Victims' Rights. Interestingly enough, we drafted it using the parallel statutes of the Ombudsman, not as a subservient, but as a side-by-side entity to enforce the rights of victims as strongly mandated by the legislature and the voters by 82-83% in 1994, clarifying the individual rights of victims in our Constitution. And Mr. Chairman, this was really the implementing statute for that constitutional amendment. And it's not an accident we took the Ombudsman office as the model and put it as a side-by-side entity, because we wanted it to have those types of powers, subpoena powers. There's few, I don't know any, the protecting the rights of victims is an additional bill of rights now that probably no one, I can't imagine one other that could be so overwhelmingly approved by the voters and mandated. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, we haven't done a great job on victims' rights, and my colleague, who certainly has unwanted experience in the issue of victims, the problems that victims have in the criminal justice system, and is a big part as a citizen now as a legislator why it's vastly improved over what it was even a decade ago. There are probably going to be anecdotes about individual cases and so forth, but this is really it's a straightforward philosophical issue. It's whether or not we should have a strong victim rights agency that has autonomy to enforce the constitutional rights of crime victims or not. And that's Mr. Samuels. Follow.
I may interrupt at this point. I forgot to recognize this morning we have with us Representative Dahl, Representative Cago, Representative Grunberg, Representative Johnson, and myself, Chair Bob Lynn, and Representative Roses has an excused absence.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ralph Samuels from District 29. And as pointed out, if you look at the philosophical creation of the Office of Victims' Rights, it stemmed from the Victims' Rights Amendment to the Constitution, which the voters overwhelmingly approved in 94. The Office of Victims' Rights, it went through several iterations. At one time, Governor Knowles vetoed the creation, and in hindsight, that was a very good thing. At that time, it was going to be housed in the executive branch, which means the office, which is an ombudsman's office, is what it is, would have been investigating the Department of Law, perhaps, or the Public Defender Agency, or the Department of Public Safety, all of whom, all roads led to the governor, so you would have been investigating yourself.
We had the fox watching the chickens.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, the Office of Victims' Rights was put into the legislative branch, and it is an ombudsman's office, which is very specialized. the regular ombudsman can go investigate if a citizen has a problem with this department or that department, with OSHA or whatever, and they have a problem with the department, the ombudsman goes and investigates for them. The Office of Victims' Rights is an ombudsman solely for victims of crime. They hire attorneys. They have their own code of ethics. And what we're trying to do is make sure that, that both of these legislative agencies, they do not answer to each other. They answer to us. We have a committee which is being formed right now as we speak to hire a new director for the Office of Victims' Rights. And that person will go through a process of getting hired by the committee and getting confirmed by the legislature. And what we want to make sure is that person answers to us and does not answer to yet a separate ombudsman's office. These two are separate entities, and neither one should have jurisdiction over the other. And that's all that the bill clarifies, actually, is that the Office of Victims' Rights is a separate and specialized ombudsman's office with special talents, and that is what was intended. And as both Representative Stoltz and I are very well aware, we were actually both very active in the creation of this. We took the language so that it would be a separate ombudsman's office. We did not mean it to be a subsect of the ombudsman's office, but it wanted it to answer directly to us as legislators.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Dahl.
Yes. If someone had a problem with how they were being treated in the Office of Victim Right, who would they then appeal to if they did not go to the ombudsman? And how would that look?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, they would come to their legislator, the same exact situation as if you had a problem with the ombudsman. It's, if you have a problem with the ombudsman, you don't think that they took your case seriously enough, you don't think whatever the complaint you've got with the ombudsman, you would go to the legislature. If you have a problem with the Office of Victims' Rights, you go to the legislature. They both answer directly to us, not to each other. And back to the statement that Representative Stoltz made earlier, they're very specialized. We're hiring attorneys that have their own training, their own code of ethics, and to have that questioned by essentially more laymen, we would rather that have them come directly to us if you have a problem, the same as if there's a problem with an ombudsman.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might also
point
out, in the legislative process, the creation of this victim's advocate was very respectful of the entire entire legislative branch, minority and majority, and hence the enhanced supermajority requirement for confirmation. I believe it's 30 votes, three quarters. So it's not a majority or minority. It's everybody has a strong voice on who that person is. If there's an objectionable person, anybody, just about anybody can stop. But it's the process was driven, and for selection was probably driven, maybe even stronger by members of then minority in the last selection process. So it was. I think it's a pretty good process we have in hand.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize Representative Johansson has joined us. Any other questions?
We'll be getting testimonies.
Yes, we'll have some other people giving testimony, I believe. I think. Representative Grinberg.
This doesn't have anything specifically to do with the Office of Victims' Rights, but the statute that you're amending is the jurisdiction of the ombudsman. I note that they've exempted all judicial officers, but they don't have the hearing officers, the administrative law judges in the new Office of Administrative Hearings. And I think this must have been written before that office was created. I'm wondering if either of you gentlemen have any thoughts on whether we ought to think about excluding them also, because they're judicial officers as well.
Mr. Chairman, it was
Representative Stoltz.
The Office of Victims' Rights predated by the original appeals judges created in the Department of Administration. But you're correct. It's the changes, the revisions made by the Murkowski administration. It was subsequent to this. So I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah, to the chair. I'm not going to suggest an amendment today, but it goes to your committee, Representative Stoltz, and it may be something to think about, because they really should have judicial independence. And I'm not talking about just hearing officers, but specifically administrative law judges.
Very good. Any other questions? If not, we have, like to testify, we have Kathy Hansen from the Office of Victims' Rights. Are you online or are you here in the audience?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Good morning there, Ms. Hansen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Hansen. I'm the interim director at the Office of Victims' Rights, and I've been a staff attorney there for 3 years. I agree with the bill that Stoltz and Samuels have put forth today. It's my understanding from the ombudsman, talking to the director and the ombudsman, that their policy is to refer any crime victims who request assistance from the ombudsman or have a complaint to the ombudsman straight to the Office of Victims' Rights without investigating. And we're happy to do that, of course. We are attorneys with criminal law experience. Every one of our attorneys has been a prosecutor, and our directors historically have all had substantial criminal law and prosecution experience. When AS 2465 was enacted in 2001, our enabling statutes for Office of Victims' Rights, the legislature had Section 200 put in that specifically says that the Office of Victims' Rights and its staff are exempt from subpoena or discovery of their files or information used during their investigation. In addition to that, the legislators put in Section 180, and that section basically says that there's not really such a thing as an appeal to the Superior Court for a discretionary decision of the victim's advocate, the director. And the purpose of that was so that the director's discretion on crime victims' complaints would be final and not subject to further review by another agency. If the ombudsman had authority to investigate our agency, then there could be disparate outcomes, unpredictable outcomes. In essence, the ombudsman could reverse a decision of the victim's advocate with possibly less information and less expertise in the area of crime victims' rights. In addition to the Office of Victims' Rights ombudsman function, our attorneys also have an advocacy function, a separate and additional function, in which we can litigate and provide free legal services to the crime victims and, when appropriate, file pleadings and appear in court and do behind-the-scenes advocacy to do things like enhance criminal punishment and, when appropriate, in a particular case during plea negotiations, and ensure that crime victims receive full restitution as constitutionally guaranteed. And that does require legal expertise to do that. There are also several things that our office can do that the ombudsman statutes as written do not do. So we have some separate things that we can access and investigate that the ombudsman can't directly access under their current statutory scheme. For example, clemency files from the governor's office. We had a situation this year that required us to look at the governor's office files and help a crime victim and look at HB 69. That's not something that the ombudsman is set up to do. The governor's is specifically exempt from review by the ombudsman, so it wouldn't be appropriate for the ombudsman to indirectly access what they're not statutorily permitted to access directly. Another example is state court judges' confidential documents and files. Those are things that we can and do look at, pre-sentence reports, for example. We can help crime victims by looking at the pre-sentence reports and advising them whether and what sentence to ask the judge for, whether to object to a plea agreement, and that's not something that the ombudsman could do directly and probably shouldn't be able to do indirectly and reverse any advice that we might give. Another big area is ongoing and criminal investigations. A substantial portion of the work we do is when cases are referred to us without action, either because of an investigation is not timely complete, because an investigation is not referred to a prosecutor, or because the prosecutor is declining to accept criminal charges. And what we can do is give the crime victim an independent legal opinion about whether the matter was timely and thoroughly investigated and whether it's a viable case for prosecution. That's not something an ombudsman would be doing. So the simple fix would to just add the language to the agency definition as proposed in HB 92. The alternative would be that we'd have to substantially restructure AS 2455 to allow the ombudsman to have those additional duties and possibly add attorney staff. We do think it's appropriate to be reporting directly to the legislature. And an additional safeguard for the Office of Victims' Rights for crime victims is that because we're bar-certified attorneys, we also have ethical duties to follow. We follow the rules of professional conduct. And one of those rules is that we provide due diligence to our clients. So in addition to complaining to a legislature about problems with the Office of Victims' Rights that might arise, they could also complain to the Alaska Bar Association for license action. I think that HB 92 just needs to make it clear so that we can stem any confusion or litigation that the legislature intended for the Office of Victims' Rights to be the special ombudsman for crime victims and the appropriate agency with the expertise to best help those crime victims. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have any questions? Representative Kernberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Hansen, I'm concerned about the fact that you may be given privileged information, and at least one agency up until now, if we hopefully will cure that in this bill, would have access to your confidential information. Is there any other way your confidential information could be obtained that we should be concerned about?
Ms. Hansen.
Through the chair, Mr. Grunberg, Representative Grunberg. No, because the AS-2465 package was carefully crafted so that there is no such thing as a subpoena for our office, for records, or for a staff member or an attorney to testify. And that was specifically placed that way so that no defense attorney could dig for information as part of the criminal process to try and get information from the victim that they couldn't get otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Ms. Hansen? Thank you for your testimony this morning. Will you be standing by for us?
Yes, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We have Linda Lord Jenkins. Is she online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Ms. Jenkins.
Good morning. I have a statement that I would like to make. First of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to be heard on House Bill 92. I must respectfully enter my opposition to House Bill 92. If this bill is passed, the legislature would take an action that no legislature has seen fit in the 32 years since the ombudsman was created. I believe this issue has arisen because an ombudsman complainant referred by my office to OVR for assistance returned to the ombudsman to complain that OVR had not adequately investigated her complaint before declining to take further action. This complainant has authorized me to discuss some aspects of this complaint, but I'm not going to discuss very much. The issue here is an issue of ensuring that a vulnerable young woman who was horribly victimized is afforded the dignity and respect and assistance to which she is entitled. I'd like to state that the Office of the Ombudsman recognizes the importance of the work done by OVR. My opposition to this bill should not be interpreted in any way as minimizing the value of the victim's advocate or the assistance it provides to victims of crime. My office routinely refers complainants to OVR if it appears that OVR is better suited to handle a complainant's issue, and I made such a referral as recently as Monday evening. I plan on continuing to do so. However, I believe that the mandate of the ombudsman enabling a legislation requires that we review or investigate complaints against state agencies, and especially so when we receive complaints about the quality of the services received after our referral. I must take exception to the characterization that OVR is a special ombudsman for crime victims. An ombudsman is an impartial fact finder, an impartial neutral, who investigates complaints about those agencies subject to its jurisdiction. The position that OVR is a special ombudsman for crime victims is contrary to every public statement of mission and purpose heretofore made by OVR. Since its inception, OVR was considered an advocate for crime victims, not an impartial investigator. Stephen Branchflower, the first victim's advocate, characterized OVR as a uniquely publicly funded victim's rights law firm. As this victim's rights law firm, OVR is authorized to represent crime victims in criminal or juvenile court proceedings to ensure that the rights provided by Alaska's constitutions and laws are afforded. Thus, while OVR is an agency created by the legislature, the best characterization of the services OVR provides to victims is as an attorney. The record reflects that OVR distinguished itself from the Ombudsman in its arguments in Cooper v. District Court, Alaska, 2006. OVR specifically argued that the Cooper Court's comparison of OVR to the Ombudsman was an error, as OVR, unlike the Ombudsman, has the responsibility of advocacy. OVR stressed the provisions of Alaska 2465.110, authorizing its advocacy for crime victims. OVR also pointed to the fact that while the Ombudsman is expressly prohibited from intervening in ongoing court proceedings, OVR is expressly authorized to intervene on behalf of crime victims. Other advocacy or investigatory agencies are within the Ombudsman's jurisdiction. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Adult Protective Services, the Department of Public Assistance Fraud Unit, the Human Rights Commission, Alaska Judicial Council, and the Alaska State Troopers all perform investigations. None are excluded from the Ombudsman's jurisdiction for fear of adding an unnecessary layer of investigation. Nor in my 19 years with the Ombudsman's office has the Ombudsman been accused of unnecessary oversight of these agencies. OVR is not unique in being either an advocate or an investigator. Its functions do not require exception from the Ombudsman's jurisdiction. Arguments that being subject to Ombudsman oversight would add an unnecessary layer of investigation or result in the Ombudsman's reversal of a discretionary decision of the victim's advocate reflect a misunderstanding of the work of the Ombudsman. It is not the authority or intent of the Ombudsman to reinvestigate victim complaints against district attorneys, law enforcement, etc. Instead, investigation of OVR's actions, whether reasonable efforts to investigate victims' complaints are made, whether more weight was given to police officers' perspective than the victim's well-being, whether victims of different backgrounds and abilities are treated equally, whether OVR complies with its own statutes and regulations is what is contemplated. Thus, it is not an additional layer of investigation of a victim complaint at issue. Nor does Ombudsman oversight present a huge burden of labor for the OVR. In the years since OVR was created, the Ombudsman has received only two complaints against the agency. One was closed because of Ombudsman review of OVR statutes in light of the Cooper decision. The other remains open pending a dispute over access to records. The fact that OVR employs attorneys and litigates does not make it unique. The Public Defender Agency, the Office of Public Advocacy, and the Department of Law all litigate and have specialized expertise. Each is an integral part of state government, providing services to thousands and affecting each and every Alaskan. The legislature placed all of these agencies within the Ombudsman's jurisdiction. And the Ombudsman is empowered to investigate these agencies without interfering with court proceedings or infringing upon the privilege of the agency's clients. OVR provides the same sort of services to Alaskans and so should be held to the same standards of oversight. Neither is it within the Ombudsman's power to contravene a discretionary action taken by a governmental agency, as long as that action is a reasonable and lawful exercise of the agency's discretion and is taken after thorough review of all the facts. If in the course of an investigation, a reasonable exercise of discretion based on relevant and proper grounds is found, the Ombudsman cannot and would not act to reverse such a decision. If, however, investigation reveals arbitrary and capricious exercises of discretion based on improper or irrelevant grounds, then the Ombudsman is authorized to suggest alternate courses of action. Additionally, we believe the fact that the OVR has access to records of active criminal investigations while the Ombudsman does not is irrelevant. The case at hand centers on the absence of investigation, including the absence of an active criminal investigation. AS 2455-160 does not preclude access to OVR's records of this victim's complaint, despite the reference to the exclusion of records of active criminal investigation. The point in the situation at hand is that we have a complainant alleging that there was no real investigation of the crime committed, that what review was done was conducted in a highly improper, totally insensitive manner, and there is no active or ongoing investigation of such crime by the police department or any other law enforcement agency. OVR's investigation, if there was or is one, does not constitute an active criminal investigation. Finally, the Ombudsman provides oversight nowhere else available to the victim's advocate. Only the Ombudsman has statutory authority to review OVR rules and OVR staff. Our review of the OVR statute does not indicate that even the legislature has access to OVR files. If not the Ombudsman, who does oversee OVR? Who oversees the Ombudsman, you may ask? The legislature oversees the Ombudsman, when the complainant grants the Ombudsman permission to discuss complaints, we discuss them with legislators. Again, I am reiterating that I am not in any way minimizing the value of the victim's advocate or the assistance it provides to victims of crime. This is not an issue of one agency being more or less important than the other. This is an issue of ensuring that a vulnerable young woman who was horribly victimized is afforded the dignity and respect and assistance to which she is entitled. For this reason, I respectfully must enter my opposition to House Bill 92. Thank you for this opportunity, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you for your input. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated that the Office of Victim in this specific case, and I don't want to get too detailed, the complaint was that there was no investigation. Are you also investigating the law enforcement agency that was responsible for this?
We do not have jurisdiction over the law enforcement agency, Mr. Johnson, through the chair. So no, we are just looking at what OVR is doing.
Thanks. I see Reverend Hawker's in the audience. Would you care to join us up here?
Thank you, sir. I'm just fine. Yeah.
Thank you. Recognize that you are in the audience. Representative Johnson.
Follow up on a different subject. Can you tell me what percentage of your cases are Office of Victims' Rights? How large is that caseload for you?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, in the time that OVR has been operating, we have only received two complaints about OVR, so it is it's negative. It's a very minute portion of our complaint. We had one other case where we had contacted OVR asking for some records that a complainant of ours had indicated OVR possessed, but we did not have a complaint against the victim's advocate. So no, we've only had two cases in 4 years.
Thank you. Reverend Dahl?
Yes. Yes, thank you. I have a question just about the Office of Ombudsman. Could you say something about how many people you have working on your staff and if that has increased or decreased over a period of, say, a decade and the kind of, just what, sort of give me a definition of your office and how it stands at this time historically?
Representative Dahl, through the chair, the Office of the Ombudsman has on staff at this time 8 people. Myself, one admin / intake officer, a separate intake officer, and 5 investigators. We have asked for an additional investigator during the coming fiscal year. The office started in 1975 with 7. We increased to 26 investigators by 1986. That was cut in half for fiscal 1987. We increased to 22 investigators in 1992. That was cut in half in fiscal 95 and further reduced in fiscal 97. We were granted one additional investigator in fiscal 2006. Our jurisdiction is to investigate complaints about the administrative actions of State of Alaska agencies. We do not have jurisdiction over elected officials. We do not have authority to intervene in matters that have been decided in court. We limit the sort of jurisdiction, the issues that we investigate by regulation. If a matter is subject to a collective bargaining agreement, such as many state employees are governed by, we don't investigate an action that would be subject to that agreement. We don't investigate actions about which the complainant has known for more than a year and not taken an action on. So someone cannot call us and say, well, back in 1996, the state did this, and I want you to look at it now. We have no statutory authority over individual municipalities unless they contract with us. We have no statutory authority over the actions of private companies, private individuals.
Okay, thank you. Just so to follow up a little bit. So you started with 26, and am I right in saying that you're at 8 now?
Representative Dahl through the chair, yes, ma'am. We started with 7. We got up to 26 in 1986.
I see.
And then it was reduced, and we are at 8 staff.
And you're at 8 right now. And your caseload has increased or decreased during this time?
Representative Dahl through the chair, the caseload this year is less than it was in 1986 and less than it was in 1995. That's more of a function of how we've done outreach and how we have how we handled complaints. For a while, we took live complaints. For a long time, we took live complaints, and that meant that when someone called, they got to an investigator or an intake person almost immediately. When our staff was cut down to 7, the acting ombudsman determined that we would not take live complaints, and we did most of our complaints through a complaint form. And that diminished the number of people coming to our office. We keep tweaking so that we can provide the best services to individuals, and our complaint load is increasing. In addition to handling just specific complaints, we have we had about 1,300 intake referrals where we send people to the proper agency to or entity to resolve questions that they may present to us. An example would be if someone is unhappy with their insurance company, we would refer them to the Division of Insurance Consumer Office. If they're unhappy with that office, then it would be a jurisdictional complaint for us. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and can my
Reverend follow-up?
Yes, thank
follow
you. Yes, thank you. So in other words, what you're saying is that you have decreasing number of people working there, but increasing complaints.
It is going up, yes, ma'am.
Yes. You know, I happen to myself feel that it's important to have checks in our government. I believe checks are an important aspect of our government, and not only in the state, but in the country as a whole. And I believe that it's important to, if anything, strengthen the Office of Ombudsman and to encourage their jurisdiction. And I believe everyone here has been given the decision or the judgment from Tamara Brandt Cook,
yes,
saying
we have a
yes,
memo
indeed
from the legal services signed by Tam Cook, dated March 23rd, and the subject: the authority of ombudsman over records of OBR.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. And in that, they say that indeed ombudsman does have jurisdiction over the Office of Victims' Rights in terms of jurisdiction. So I would like to support the ombudsman in this bill and vote no.
Thank you. We had Representative Grunberg, you wanted to talk again to Ms. Jenkins, did you?
Yes, please.
Excuse me, Ms. No. Hansen, are you still there?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah. Reverend Grunberg had a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hansen, does the state bar have any, could somebody basically file an ethics complaint against any members of your staff with the state bar, people who are attorneys?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, they could. Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct require individual attorneys to exercise due diligence when representing their crime victim clients in this case. And any person could complain to the Bar Association. There's a website with a click on the complaint, phone number to call, toll-free number. If there was a complaint that Office of Victims' Rights was not following its own statutes, then certainly they could go to court for court action to have a court issue an order that we aren't following our own statutes and should be. And also they could go to the legislature.
Through the chair, if that process were followed, what access would they have to your records, et cetera?
Limited access. The court would only be able to look at whether we're following our own statutes. And there's, again, 170, AS 2465-180 is the statute that talks about what review the Superior Court judges can do. AS 2465-200 gives our office the statutory privilege not to disclose our records by subpoena or through discovery in court proceedings. In order to answer your question more fully, I need to, if I may, through the chair, explain more about the Freitag case that's the subject of the subpoena.
One moment, please, Reverend Grinberg.
Yeah, we don't have, unfortunately, unlimited time in the committee. I'm not going to fully explore this. I did have two very quick questions, and I'd like a quick answer. How about the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, and how about the legislature itself, Ledge Council, Legislative Budget and Audit, or the Judiciary Committee? Would any of them have any jurisdiction to investigate complaints?
What I have seen happen in practice is that individual legislators will inquire through their aides, and then we provide them with all the information that they request and need to answer that particular crime victim's concern.
How about the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics?
I believe we're required to follow that as well, and that certainly they could review us as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right, thank you. Any other questions for anybody, either Ms. Hanson or Ms. Jenkins at this point? Reverend Stoltz or Reverend Samuels, would you care to do a wrap-up presentation, and we'll close public testimony?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Bill Stoltz from Chugiak. I'd just like to, probably one of the larger reasons this is before us as one, and I appreciate the legal services memo we just got. I think that strengthens our need to do this. There is a question and ambiguity that clarifies the need to pass this statute. And probably the larger issue that I hadn't mentioned in my opening was the caseloads of the different entities. The Ombudsman's Office, a very large percentage of their caseload are convicted felons through the prison system. And the issue, real concerns we had in developing the Office of Victims' Rights was obviously sensitivity toward victims and just the inherent conflicts investigating. It wouldn't take very long for one to bump into another when you're investigating the claim of a convicted felon who is incarcerated, and you're bumping into a victim's rights issue. It doesn't take very long with any kind of expanded caseload. And I mean, there was such a level of insensitivity of sensitivity that I think it was Brant McGee from Office of Victims. What was it?
OPA.
Originally, we had the Office of Victims Advocacy, and there is a concern that the names are too close together, and people. That's the level of sensitivity, Mr. Chairman. So we changed the name in the drafting process and through the committee process. One thing I would mention on the budgets, there are. You can compare the two budgets of the entities. The Office of Victims' Rights. Was created through a funding mechanism that doesn't use general funds. It's totally off budget. And it takes it's funded through the use of dividends from convicted felons, and it also spun off to fund a lot of other entities, including CDVSA, victims compensation, and a whole slew of other entities. So that was a nice side product. Office of Victims' Rights isn't asking the legislative branch for money. The Ombudsman is certainly coming forward asking for another $100,000 this year, and it doesn't escape me that a big chunk of their constituency that they respond to are people that are incarcerated felons, and we're in a real world and we have emotions that sort of rubs me, and I know you can identify with some of that, some of the members of the committee, and that's let's see. And on the jurisdictional, I was just trying to follow through comparing this with a lot of other entities like Office of Human Rights. This is unlike those. This is an entity housed within our legislative branch, and the director is confirmed by a supermajority of the legislature. That's a a very significant difference between all those other entities. And with that, I mentioned at the beginning, this is deeply rooted in philosophy, and it's I've heard a little bit about the reference case, and it's a very sympathetic case, and it's and I don't know whether it was botched up. There was evidentiary issues, and you know, these things are complicated, and they're victims' rights cases are also fraught with a lot of emotion, and I don't know. You know, it's I don't know the facts, and the one case probably isn't as it's certainly important, but probably not enough to change your determination whether or not this entity should be independent. Is I can give you all my I can express very certainly that was the will of the legislature, being in on the birthing.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Stoltz, Representative Samuels? Do you have anything to add?
No, I just follow up that the branches of government is a huge issue. Investigating the legislature creates an ombudsman to make sure that the executive branch is agencies are doing what the citizens want them to do. But both of these are created to be equal, and I disagree with Ms. Lord Jenkins. It was created after an ombudsman statute, and you can go to the Bar Association, and you can go to the Ethics Committee, you can go to your legislator, the same as if you had a problem for an ombudsman. If you always have to have someone looking over your shoulder, you'd have yet another ombudsman's office and yet another one on top of that. Both of them go to the legislature. What are you going to do if you have a complaint against the ombudsman? You go to the legislature, the same as right now with the Office of Victims' Rights. There are other avenues within the legislature that people can go to political action. And then, of course, the conflict. If you're investigating a woman who was raped and you are investigating a complaint by the man who raped her at the same time, you have a problem. So I'd say that is why we just want to try to separate them. It shouldn't be there only been the two complaints. There are other avenues of complaints. If you don't like the Office of Victims' Rights action, there are other avenues that you can take.
Basically, you're saying a conflict of office within ombudsman's office.
Potentially. You never know. I don't think there's only been the two complaints so far. You have other avenues to take a complaint against OVR. You have avenues to take complaints against the ombudsman, but to have them separate, I know, is the intent. I was here, and Representative Stoltz was here when it was created. That's why it's in the legislative branch.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might expand further, the type of activity the Office of Victims' Rights has been aggressive on defending is where the victims gets lost in the shadow of justice is through that lengthy appellate process. They think it's all done and reduction of sentence hearings. The type of person that's going through all those every possible avenue of appeal to which is certainly understandable is also the same type of person that's filing appeals with the ombudsman's office. They're the same animal, and I use that only just in a generic human. I didn't mean.
In a verbal sense, okay. thank you very much. Any other questions? If not, I'll close public testimony. Is anybody in the audience would like to testify on this? Anybody else online? If not, I'll close public testimony and open it up to the committee for discussion. I see Representative Coghill has pulled out one of the statutes here, and you may have something to shed light on here.
Mr. Chairman, I think, first of all, the fact that the rights of crime victims rose to the level of a constitutional amendment, Article 1, Section 24, gives it kind of a special place. And so I'm going to vote for the bill because I really do believe that one of the troublesome things in our justice system is that justice sometimes can be lost in the process. And this, I think, gives us the opportunity to focus that process. The accountability issues are real. And I think Linda Lord Jenkins brought up some of them. I think we'll need to watch. I don't know that we want to just drop those recommendations and even arguments against this particular bill. So as long as I'm in public life, I'll watch that. But I do believe that because of the special nature of the victims of really the justice system, as well as the victims of crime, perpetrated upon them is a real issue. And so I'm going to be in favor of the bill.
Okay. Any other comment among the committee? Representative Gruenberg, then I'll ask for a motion.
Mr. Chair, they say that difficult cases can make bad law. The ombudsman, as Representative Stoltz said, has a high level of cases where they represent defendants. And that would create a real chilling effect on the Office of Victims' Rights if they could turn around then and investigate the agency that represents the victims. That would be a significant conflict of interest. That would be the normal case. This case that has been brought to our attention is an unusual case where the allegation was that the agency that's supposed to represent the victim didn't represent the victim. And it's an unusual case, and if we didn't do something about it, it could potentially create a much larger problem with the fact that the ombudsman's more often representing the other side, the defendant. And so it's flipped around, and that has caused the problem, one of the problems here. The other issue is, it's like the old song, who's keeping watch on the lighthouse keeper's daughter while the lighthouse keeper's keeping the light? And that really was a song, and you may remember that.
I only remember Minuet and G.
But there was a song like that, and maybe some other people who are listening or in the audience do. It was before my time, but there was a song. The question is, who would potentially people go to if they have a problem with the Office of Victims' Rights? And as Ms. Hansen said, there is the state bar, legislative ethics, and potentially some committees in the legislature. So I think there are other places to go to address that problem rather than this particular agency, which quite often, more often than not, would have a real serious conflict of interest. And I am sensitive to what my friend, the representative from Juneau, has said, and it may be that at some point we'll want to visit with the ombudsman on the committee. I assume we have jurisdiction on the ombudsman, but that's an issue for another day. And more to Ms. Hansen than anybody else, I am very much a fan of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and at some point those quasi-judicial officers might want to be also exempted from the statute, but that's not within this bill at this point. But I will support the bill because I don't want I want to keep our eye on the main issue, which is the far greater caseload where there could be a serious conflict of interest.
Would you care to make a motion to move the bill, Representative Gruenberg?
With individual recommendation.
With individual recommendation.
So moved. I do want my friend to know what I'm doing. Yeah.
So moved by Representative Gruenberg. Any objections? If not, House Bill 92.
I beg your pardon. I do object.
You'll be fine. Thank you. I beg your pardon. We'll take a roll call vote, please.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Representative Dahl?
No.
Representative Roses, not present. Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Johansson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Chair Lynn?
Yes.
5 yea, 1 nay.
And with that, HB 92 has passed out, is on its way to the Finance Committee, and congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
A lot of problems need to be resolved, and we'll step forward to it. Thank you. Okay, next up, we'll take our IDs while we sign the paperwork. The House State Affairs Committee back into order at 11 a.m. We'll now take up House Bill 151, and I have a CS for House Bill 151. 51, that's 25-LS0479-E, and I'll entertain a motion to adopt CS for version E.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make the motion that we adopt the E version for CS for House Bill 151.
Okay, without objection, Representative Johnson, you are the sponsor of this. Representative Johnson, by request, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Craig Johnson, District 28, and I have with me Trevor Fulton, who is staff, who will go through the changes of the CS. Basically, the CS was like a lot of legislation. When you start out, and the great thing about the committee process is you do get to fine-tune things, and this bill cast a much wider net when I was originally introduced than I'd intended. So, in essence, all of the changes are to narrow that net down to the title has been changed to add construction trade type units as opposed to a much broader net, which took in financial advisors and everything else. And the last thing this representative wants to do is to do anything that would cost the permanent fund dividend money. And we might have done that. I don't see anyone objecting to that. So what the CS basically does is narrows it down to design engineers, construction trades, which was the intended legislation in the first place, to level the playing field, to save the state money, and quite honestly, to make it easier to do business in the state for those particular professionals. And with that, my staff, Trevor, with the pleasure of the committee, would go through the changes. If that would be the will of the committee.
Continue.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Representative Craig Johnson. And like the representative was saying, there's two basic changes between the bill as it was addressed last week and the bill today, the committee substitute. The first change was to, and if you'll refer to the legal services memorandum that was should have been included in the committee packet, that outlines the line for line the changes that were made and the changes that are in the new committee substitute. One of the changes was to incorporate the amendment that the committee addressed last week, and that essentially simply added defense to the clause indemnification, defense, and hold harmless provision. If there's any questions to that, we do have people here who can address them better than I. The other major change to the committee substitute was to, like the representative said, add construction-related professional services. And again, I'll just reiterate that was to the bill, so it didn't have any unintended consequences outside of its intent.
Excuse me.
Okay. Representative Dahl had a hand up first.
Yes, I simply need to have that memorandum. I don't believe I have that.
Do we have that here?
Thank you.
Do you?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having just sat through countless hours on an unnamed bill,
would that be HB 109?
Yeah. The term consultant has achieved not only a connotation, not only a denotation, but a connotation. And
stigma.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stigma. And the use of that term invites a heightened scrutiny by not only people in this building, but the general public. And I, not wishing to give these professionals a black eye before they even get the bill off the ground here, I'm wondering, and I see Mr. Walsh was around here somewhere. In the back, he's smiling and waving his hand.
He's referring to Mr. Walsh in the back there.
Yeah, John Walsh, who represents these folks. I'm just wondering, as the bill moves through, you might want to consider using another term that would be a little less controversial. Just a thought.
Mr. Chairman, if I
might. Is this bill also gender neutral, is it?
If I might. I think that's a point well taken, and in a previous life, I actually was a consultant, and during the campaign, I was reluctant to tell people that I was a consultant because of that black eye. But consultants do serve a very important purpose.
Of course.
I mean, if you don't have legislators consulting on legislative business outside of that, I think you're talking about a very honorable profession that it's companies that can't afford to hire their own people can bring in people for very specific things. So I think that, you know, they're, you know, even banks started out as money changers in the church. And we know what happened to the money changers in the church, but the banking industry has come along and done quite well. We're still changing money. So I don't want to jump on the bandwagon of consulting as a negative.
Fine.
So, but I do appreciate your comment, and I want to, for one, think that, you know, we hire consultants in this body.
Fine. I may have overstated that.
No, I don't think you did. You know, the magic of language. There are all kinds of issues, and we fog the issue with different terms, so we don't want to get into that with this. Go ahead, please. Are you through? Any questions? If not, we have online with us, I believe, Margie Vandoor with the Attorney General Office. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you please identify yourself and give us your testimony?
I have no testimony, but this is Margie Vandoor from the Attorney General's office. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I am online simply for questions if the committee has any.
Thank you. Any questions for her? If not, thank you. Boyd Mogenthaler, are you online, sir?
Yes. Chairman Lynn, members of the committee, my name is Boyd Mogenthaler. I represent the Alaska Professional Design Council. APDC is a consortium of professional society that represents the 5,000 architects, engineers, and land surveyors registered in Alaska. HB 151 is an important issue for all Alaskan consultants, and APDC supports HB 151 in the version that you have before you. This bill, as you know, is about liability. When two parties enter a contract, each party expects the other to be responsible for their own actions. And in particular, each party is responsible for their sole liabilities. In contracts that we commonly enter into, there are two terms that we experience repeatedly, indemnification and hold harmless. Hold harmless is simply an agreement by one party to not hold the other party responsible for certain acts or under certain circumstances. And indemnification is an extension of that that says that one party will be financially underwrite the loss of the other party under certain circumstances. The real issue here is not the sole negligence of the two parties, but who's responsible when there's a joint liability. The Department of Transportation takes a very fair approach to this, and they say that when there's joint liability, it should be shared on a comparative fault basis. And that's exactly what HB 151 requires. It's just common sense fairness. Unfortunately, not all public agencies have the same approach as ADOT. Some agencies require the consultant to take responsibility for all liability except for the agency's sole negligence. So if the agency is 99% at fault, the consultant still pays 100% of the cost because there's no apportionment of cost on a comparative fault basis. In the last 6 months, as an industry here in Alaska, we have battled the Alaska Railroad, the University of Alaska, and the Mat-Su Borough, and other public agencies on this issue. In all the cases that we've faced, these agencies have demanded that the consultant, and I understand the distinction we just discussed, and perhaps we've call it professional services consultant, but they've demanded the architects, engineers, and land surveyors to assume 100% of the joint liability. The Alaska Railroad even went so far as requiring indemnification, and I quote, from and against all claims and actions asserted by a third party or parties resulting from the services performed. This is just an absolutely unlimited liability. It's not the public that is demanding these liabilities. Whenever we've discussed it with the Board of Regents or the officers, assembly people, project managers, they generally are looking for a fair indemnification. But the problem we're facing comes from contracting officers. And as contracting officers change, so do the indemnification languages. For example, in the Mat-Su borough, they had a one-sided indemnification that we battled through 2001, and in 2002 they changed it to the DOT format, which lasted through all of last year. But now they have a new contracting officer. He scratched what we battled for, and now we're back to the same old one-sided language. So you can see the problem. Our life has become a perpetual trip to Chuck E. Cheese. You know, it's that game with the popping heads, and we just can't seem to beat them down as fast as they pop up. This cost the architect, engineer, land surveyors in Alaska, and ultimately the public, millions of dollars in wasted time every year as we fight just to have fair contract language. The impacts are important, and there are three major impacts that we experience. Number one is that the contracts become uninsurable. Our professional liability insurance only covers damages to the extent caused by our negligence, but it doesn't extend to the negligence of the other party. So when we are required to carry all of the middle ground, we're not insured. And no insurance company, well, actually, we had one insurance agency tell us that we can get insurance for anything, but we were looking at $2 million to pay for the policy and $1 million deductible. I think that was an exaggeration, but I think you get the point. The other thing that happens is that good consultants walk away from agency work. You know, paradoxically, it's the consultants that really understand risk that are in the best position to help the owner with their project. And yet it's these very same consultants who won't sign in onerous language. So that leaves the owner with consultants who can either make themselves judgment-proof, who are willing to take the risk, but then oftentimes will enter into defensive design techniques to limit their risk, which causes project prices to go up. And the bottom line is there's no free lunch. And finally, we're forced to raise our prices. We do this by capturing the millions of dollars of overhead that we spend each year in our hourly rates, and we also do that by increasing the prices in our contracts to compensate for the additional risk. HB 141 is a great model to follow. It follows the DOT language, which has been successfully used for decades. It will standardize indemnification requirements for all public agencies. It'll level the playing field, and in our mind, it's just fair, honest, and the right thing to do. So we strongly encourage you to pass this legislation.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Morgenthaler? If not, thank you for your testimony. Is Leanne Boldenow there, please, from Marsh?
Yes, hello. And I thank the chair and the committee members for an opportunity to represent the insurance industry, as I am a client executive from Marsh USA, an insurance brokerage that has represented architects and engineers around the state for 10 years. It's very typical to have a contract presented to us for insurability, and as we review the indemnification clause, the requirement for the design professional consultant to take on all liabilities, claims, and hold harmless, we have to notify the design firm that their professional liability insurance cannot take on liabilities that are not directly connected to negligent errors, acts, and omissions. So the House Bill 151 specifically identifies that and would alleviate this problem. So I'm simply here today to support the APDC and the bill, and I am also a member of the APDC Contract Committee and do frequently witness these contracts from their aspect in supporting that these agency contracts are outside the design professional's professional liability.
Thank you very much. Representative Grunberg, you had a question?
Yes, Ms. Bolden. We have occasionally seen a situation where the legislature is asked to draft, maybe even repeal or amend a statute because of insurance problems. Because insurance doesn't cover the situation. Sometimes this comes up in the healthcare field, sometimes in other fields. And I would just hate to have us go through this whole thing and have some insurance company somewhere say, this still doesn't do it. Are you absolutely certain that the entire insurance industry, with this language, will, with standard coverage, now cover these professionals? Or should we put anything in the bill or something in there that basically ensures that that doesn't occur?
I can say I'm absolutely certain. I've also reached out to my insurance company claims attorneys that have reviewed the bill and the contracts that have caused issues, and the contracts that are causing the issues are outside the insurance provisions. To bring them inside, this bill does meet those requirements.
You said does or does not?
Does.
And if I may, one more question.
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Okay, I just... I don't know if there's anything we can do or need to do so that that wouldn't change over time, because I know sometimes the insurance industry, when an action like this is taken, if they no longer want to cover these things, they'll then change their contract so that they don't. And a sad case that comes to mind is the case that recently has occurred with the flood problems in the southern United States. Is there anything that, anything else we can do to prevent that happening around here in this situation?
I'd like to respectfully say that, unfortunately, insurance does direct how business is conducted, but it's because of the risk. And yes, you're right, sometimes insurance will take a new position, but that's because they're not able to make a profit or be successful. But in this case, I have watched this for 10 years, so I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't know what risk will transpire in the future.
Through the chair. I'm not pointing any fingers at the industry, and obviously there are some risks that no insurance could cover, like that horrible storm. You've done about the best I think you can. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Bodenau? Okay. Anybody else off net? Everybody? Okay. We have an audience. I ask if you would like to. We have a Mark O'Brien, the contact officer, just for questions. Are you here to add anything? Thank you, sir, for coming this morning. John Walsh, any comment you'd like to make?
No, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much. If that's it, then I'll close public testimony. And I'm ready for some guidance here. What would we like to do with this bill? Representative Dahl?
I would like to move the bill, 25LS0479/E, to move that bill on committee.
Okay. Could you stand by just a moment, please? Looks like you have an amendment that needs to be passed. Everybody have a copy of this? It's a memorandum, actually.
No, that's the CS.
That is the CS?
Right. Which we adopted.
Eddie.